So we literally took a corporate jet to fly out to Skywalker Ranch, and I read Episode One sitting in a rocking chair on George Lucas's porch. I'm like,
really?
Welcome to Game Dev Advice, the Game Developers Podcast. I'm your host, John J.P. Podlasic. I've worked at 10 different game companies, starting back in 1989 with the TurboGrafx-16. Over the decades, I've developed games like Mortal Kombat, Avengers Initiative, Beavis and Butthead, and numerous others. I now work for a startup called Level X. But this podcast isn't about me. It's about you and the game development community. So if you have questions or ideas, give a call, 224-484-7733, or go to the gamedevadvice.com website. I have a great episode for you today, so let's kick things off with the new Game Dev Advice. Apologies for the long break. Been crazy busy. Have a fantastic guest today, Chris Nicolella. He's launched over 200 licensed and original toy and video game products, including bestsellers like Furby, Pokemon, Star Wars, Marvel, NBA Live, and FIFA Soccer. He's worked at companies like EA, Hasbro, SteelSeries, and NEC's TurboGrafx, just to name some. Today we talk about making games, making toys, living in Thailand as an expat, going to Skywalker Ranch, movie deals, Hong Kong, and a lot more. Hey Chris, how's it going?
It is going great, John. Good talking to you. How are you?
Doing good. You've been traveling and doing all kinds of cool stuff. Like, what are you up to now?
So I did something pretty bold just over a year ago. I decided that I didn't want to live in America anymore. So I just packed up everything. Well, I sold a lot of everything, and I moved to Bangkok, Thailand. So I've been an expat living in Thailand for I'm on month 13, so just over a year.
That's wild.
It's just really, really wild. I didn't tell a lot of people for a long time. It's not something I just decided to do, like, you know, just woke up one day like, hey, Thailand sounds cool, let me go here. Something that I've been working on for a long time in years, and it actually started, you know, many years ago, when I started all my trips over to Asia, going into China and Hong Kong for manufacturing and stuff like that. So it's been something that I've been working on, coming to Bangkok for a couple of years. I started thinking about it really seriously in 2016, and in 2018 is really where I felt like I'm in a position where it's easy enough for me to do it. I pulled the trigger. I just sold my car, sold my TV, put most of everything else in storage, and I came out here with two suitcases, my Xbox, and my laptop computer and my smartphone, and that was it. That's all.
Wow.
It was kind of sad. I'm like, this is all I have to my name. And my friends are like, you have properties back in the States. It's not all you have to your name.
Right. No, it's pretty bold. Yeah, and I give you credit for doing that, because a lot of people are like, yeah, that would be cool. And then they never get off their ass and do it. And they don't have the motivation or the drive to do it. So I give you a ton of credit for
Thank you. The last couple of months, I started asking more and more people what they think. And it was, I got bipolar answers. Either everyone was, they were either like, that's amazing, that's awesome, or you're crazy, what are you doing? And I would always like go after the people that would say, you're crazy, we're doing, like, what do you mean? Why do you think it's crazy? And a lot of times people would just have misconceptions. Like, why are you moving to a third world country? And I'm like, oh boy. I'm like, well, Thailand is really not a third world country.
Right.
And they're like, it's not. And I would say stuff like, I'm like, well, first of all, they have Uber and they have, you know, their mass transit is amazing. I go, people come to Thailand to get surgeries because the doctors and the hospitals are, you know, on par with the US and like an eighth
fraction
of the price. Yeah. Right. And I go in, and the infrastructure is amazing. They don't have, you know, rolling blackouts, and the streets are paved. And I go, it's one of the safest cities.
Food.
The food is amazing. And then I tell them about how strong the US dollar is to the Thai baht. Like, I'm like, I go, you can go so much further here than you can back home. And they would still say I'm crazy.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's just, it was just an easy step for me to do, just from the standpoint that, you know, I'm not married. I don't have any kids. I felt like I was still young enough to take the risk.
Right.
And so far, it's gone really well. I mean, the first few months were definitely a little rough. I came right at probably the worst rainy season they ever had.
Oh, the monsoons, so, all that.
Yeah, it was really tough. Like there was one day I got trapped in a 7-Eleven, and it was raining so hard, so fast that the water started coming up from the sewage inside the 7-Eleven. So 7-Eleven started to flood. So I had to take refuge somewhere else.
Slurpees for everyone. All right.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, Slurpees and get the hell out of here, because we got to clean up an aisle everywhere.
Right.
And so that was tough. And then I just had the initial shock of anxiety shock, I would say, of like, oh my God, what did I really do? I just quit a really good job. Mm-hmm. I moved 8,000 miles away, where I know basically nobody, and I have almost nothing to do day to day. So there were times, I would say, like the first couple of months, I'd wake up in like 2-3 in the morning and like little panic and anxiety attacks. And I would just have to like, it's going to be okay. I'm planning this. I know what I'm doing. I did the math, you know, it's fine. And more than anything, I'm like, I got to do it for at least a year. Just got to suck it up for a year and, you know, and just really give it a chance. And and month by month it got easier. I got into a routine. I wouldn't get lost as much in the city.
Right.
You start your life over. You know you have to learn the culture and just get your way around, and just you know, things are not as easy as they are for, you know, if you're in the US and do certain things. But it's not difficult, but it's just a new way of doing things day to day. So, So I dig it. I dig it a lot. I'm very glad I made the move.
No. And again, hats off to you, because you know, there's always that, I always think about the back of my mind is that, you know, rocking chair regret, right? Like you're 80 or 85 and you're sitting there and you got your whatever depends on, and you're like, God damn it, I should have done that, you know, and you're still young enough and healthy enough. And you said, I'm going to do it. I'm not just going to dream about it and then regret it, you know, when I'm old and semi-senile and wish I had done something different. So that's huge. And I think it's cool that you did that.
Oh, thanks, man. Yeah. Thank you.
So kind of looping back to, you know, making trips over there and stuff. There's a two-part question here, but, you know, the first is kind of like, how did you get started in the video game industry? And then, you know, what you like better, working on video games or working in the toy industry, and how are they different?
Sure. So I got my start with you, my friend. So I started working at TurboGrafx-16. I started, I think, a year after you. I started in 91. I graduated from high school in 90. So I don't remember. I don't think I worked that summer of 90. I'm pretty sure I worked 90-93. I was the 12 to 4 shift with Gallo and Al was there and stuff like that.
Oh yeah.
You know, on the tip line as well. And and part of the reason how I got the job was I lived in Wooddale, Illinois, where the headquarters was. So it was easy, it was convenient, and you know, I heard about it. And then one of my friends, his mom was knew somebody that worked there, and that's really how I got my start was there. So it was great. You know, I worked at the Wooddale office for the first year and a half, and then I moved over to the 800, the service center for customer service, like if your TurboGrafx broke or put in the card upside down and stuff like that. And that office was in Aurora. And I think that was a longer shift. I think it was an 8-hour shift instead of a 4-hour one. So it was great to get the extra time. And I think it was a little bit higher pay at the time as well. So, which made the commute, you know, a little bit good going from Wooddale to Aurora each day. So TurboGrafx was my first real gig in the video game industry. But I got really blessed that from the standpoint that, I did, you know, I got to work both worlds. I got to work in the video game world and also in the toy industry. You know, and,
yeah, you've done a ton of toy stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, to be really honest, I think my video game career, I'll add it all up, I think is maybe 6-7 years. The biggest role I had was working at, well, first it was called New FX. And they were in Hoffman Estates.
Yeah, off of Hassel Road there, Lou Hain and those guys, yeah.
Yes, yeah. Lou and Pat were great, great guys. Right across the street from High Voltage. Mm-hmm. And so I worked there initially. And at the time, they were only doing games for EA, for Electronic Arts. And then after my first year there, EA bought them. And then I became an EA Chicago employee automatically.
And then they moved, right? And they built it. Yeah, they had a big space downtown.
Yeah,
I remember the big party, and they had, you know, all the different floors and crazy chairs and the huge kitchen with all this stuff. And it was, yeah, they had a big spread, big burn rate too, right? I'm sure that was not cheap.
They did. I left right before they went downtown. I left in 2005, and that's when I went to another toy company, and it was a startup toy company from a lot of the ex Hasbro employees I used to work with, and so I did that, and that was really great. So you know, I got to, you know, working in both fields was really great from the standpoint that you know, toys and video games, they do share a lot of similarities from the standpoint of how a project gets made. Toys obviously has a much simpler path. Shorter cycles and stuff like that. But the great thing about toys is you get to learn about manufacturing, and you have a big role as far as understanding the market trends, how retail works, how buying works.
Yeah.
And everything.
End caps and all that, like retail stuff.
Right? Yeah. You know, and then you learn all the code words, like what is a X factory cost means, what's a VOM, what's an FOB cost. You know, there's all these terminologies that the retail world uses, and they still use it. It's kind of archaic in some ways, but it's that they haven't really modified and changed it. But I mean, it still kind of works, even though the retail market is shrinking all the time. But it was it's interesting. It's interesting from that standpoint to do both. I mean, if you had to ask me which I like better, I mean,
yeah.
Look, making video games is really, really cool if it's your 100% passion, you know. Mm-hmm. I'm sure you've had this conversation many times with friends and family from the standpoint that it's a tough job. I mean,
it is. It can be a grind.
You have to dedicate your life to making a video game. You know, you have to sacrifice seeing the sun, you know, seeing friends, seeing family, you know, I think
crunch wars.
And it's just, you know, it's tough, and you better hope that the game you're working on, you're really passionate about it, because you're going to be working on it for the next 18 months. And it's grueling. It's really grueling. I think the longest I ever went without a day off was 9 weeks, 9 or 10 weeks. And then the longest shift I ever worked without going home was like 36 hours or something like that. It was crazy.
Really crazy. Start getting delirious.
There was even one time we were finaling a game. I think it was a FIFA game I was working on. And even back in the day, it was, you know, we didn't have smartphones yet. It was like 2003 or something like that. We still had cell phones. Yeah. But Lou and Pat were all about, like, you have to have a pager when the game is getting finalized and going gold. I'm like, why? Like, we don't trust cell phones, pagers. The you know, the call always comes in if something breaks and you have
it to works it for off. Doctors, damn it, just get it.
exactly. So I'm like, all right, people are gonna laugh at me, but I'll put the pager on during, you know, the last 4 or 5 weeks when, you know, we're submitting to Sony and Microsoft. It was a Saturday night, and I was standing up at my buddy's wedding. And the wedding already it was like 1:30 in the morning, 2 in the morning. Pager goes off that the build crashed, and I have to call the team in. So the team was small, so I only had to call like 4 or 5 people in. But sucked to do that and to wake them up and hear them complain and yell at me. But the great thing is I got there first, and and they got to see me, you know, they're walking the office, stumbling the office at 2 a.m. and like,
in a tuxedo.
Well, Chris, if I knew you were going to wear a tuxedo to greet me in here, I'm like, I wouldn't have yelled at you on the phone. I'm like, ha ha, yeah.
Right. Sorry, this is a wedding, jerks. Get in here.
So at least that made it a little less painful.
From
that standpoint, I don't know about you, but the analogy, I used to always hide and not tell a lot of people that I made video games and stuff like that. Especially like, if I wore a gaming t-shirt, I got real smart real quick, saying like, I got it from a friend instead of like, oh, I work at EA. And then, that stranger you just met wants to be your best friend.
Yeah, totally. Right. Like, start talking your ear off and like, I got this great idea for a game. It's like, yeah, whatever, dude. Exactly. Like, a million people have a million ideas for games despite execution.
Sure. But the video game dream crusher analogy that I used to love to tell people is they're like, wow, you make video games. That's so awesome. And I used to say, it's fun to drive a Ferrari. It's not fun to make one. And they'd be like, yeah, I can kind of see that.
Right.
You're like, don't get me wrong. Look, I love the time that I worked in video games, but it's hard. It's really, really hard. It's grueling. And and I think even in the role I was in, and I think you were in too, being a producer from that standpoint, it's tough. You have to be responsible and oversee so many aspects of the game. Mm-hmm. And I don't know about you, but I always felt like at EA, even when something went wrong that really wasn't a producer aspect, I still got it was still so right. I'm like, okay.
And if it's anything that affects the schedule, then it's kind of on you, right? So it's like, you didn't do that thing, but it impacts the schedule, so figure it out.
Exactly. But you know what? It was great from the standpoint that I got to work with so many people at EA Chicago that were super talented, super nice, way smarter than me. to just be a part of the games I worked on at EA Chicago was great. You know, I dabbled a little bit on iPhone games. You know, I saw the light bulb on apps really early, like when I started just I didn't get the original iPhone because I wasn't impressed that it only had Edge, but when they did 3G, Edge was, I'm like, okay, you only have at max 8 gigs of memory and it's Edge. Well, it was so
slow. Try doing Outlook on Edge on an iPhone. I remember doing that and like take 5 minutes for an email to load.
Right. But when they when year one happened and they did the iPhone 3G and then they opened up the App Store and I started seeing some of these games. These games were so easy, so simple.
Yeah, like those farting games that made $1 million a day. You're like,
cleaning up. And then I started to do the research and I'm like, what, the kit to start programming is $100? And you can already use the computer that you have to start programming and do the audio and the graphics. I'm like, this is a no-brainer. So I made a couple of iPhone apps that were actually published that were able to get in the on the App Store, which was great.
Right.
I came in, unfortunately, right when the video game publishers realized, like, hey,
there's money here.
Yeah. And then they just started, they started outspending everybody.
User acquisition, right? So they had, the much deeper pockets, and they could throw more money at buying players and running UA and doing all that. And then it's more of an arms war, and it's not so much about the ideas.
It really was. And it's too bad. I wish I would have started just a little bit sooner. And I had, I used all my own personal funding to hire programmers and graphic artists and stuff like that. And I really wish I could have got the third game I was working on was really cool. It used Bluetooth between two devices where you can pass like colored pucks back and forth. So as I slid a puck off my iPhone screen, it would appear instantaneously with no latency on your screen to pass it back.
Because it's Bluetooth and you're within what, 40 feet or something like that.
It was great. It was really, really great. But I just, for me to like really put it out would have cost like marketing dollars, like maybe between 60 to 100,000. I'm like, I don't have that money, and two, I can't take a risk like that. So
So what about working at EGM and going to GamePro? Because you also had that whole period where you're in the publishing site. Talk about that.
Yeah. That was an unbelievably awesome time. So, after, TurboGrafx-16 shut its doors, I decided like, I'll go to school. So I wanted to go to Columbia, but I couldn't afford Columbia. so I thought the best way, like, I'll go to COD, I'll go to College of DuPage, get all my generals in.
Right.
And then from there, hopefully I'll be able to transfer credits and get maybe some type of partial scholarship, whatever, to help with going to Columbia. Mm-hmm. And, I was just about ready to finish up my first year at COD, and Al Manuel, after Turbo closed his doors, he made his way over to EGM. And I remember one day he called me up, he goes, "Hey man, we're hiring. Do you want in?" And I'm like, mm-hmm. It was hard for me to say no. I'm like, oh my God, to get back into the video game industry in some regards, I have to do it. And EGM was great in the early days from that standpoint. Like my interview process was talk to a managing editor who was younger than me, and I was only 21. And they're like, "Here are these 5 games. Let's see how fast or how good you are at playing them."
Okay.
And that was my interview. Not like, "Let me see your past editorial skills or articles you've written in the past." Nobody even asked if I could spell, which was good because at the time I really couldn't.
That's funny. Like just play these games.
Play this game. And I remember I had to play. I played Street Fighter II on the Super NES, and I had to play. I played Ken, who was Sushi X, at NES. And I beat him. I only beat him one game, 1 out of 3 games. But even that, they were like, "Oh, you beat Ken? You beat our Sushi X guy? You're hired." I'm like, "Okay." And I'm, the great thing about EGM back in the day was it was
back in the day. Just to kind of frame it for listeners, back in the day was that's like 94 to 99 or
yeah, so. Like I started issue. Issue 50 is when I started. I'm not in the masthead in issue 50. They already closed it, but from issue 51 to 63 is the issues that I wrote for the magazine issues I wrote. Oh, and it was I think it was 93 to 94. I only worked there like just over a year.
Okay.
And it was great. It was John. It was really like a frat house. I mean, it was just kids running amok, and it was.
Right. Well, who was the guy with the Viper? Because he used to come by NEC all the time, and he used
that was Steve Harris. That was
Steve Harris, right.
So,
Steve Harris comes, we got to be nice to him. It's like, okay,
exactly. Yeah. He was always nice to me, and he had he was difficult with other people, but he was super super nice to me. I learned a lot there. I learned real desktop publishing, really stuff. Like, we did everything at EGM. We would play the game, take our screenshots, lay out the, what the page looked like in Cork. We opened up, Photoshop like 2.0. mm-hmm. And, we'd pick out our backgrounds. We designed stuff. I learned what a scanner was. I learned how to scan stuff. It was like the first time I ever heard the word internet. it was crazy. I learned so much at EGM, and even there was like working crazy hours as well. Like there were times I slept on desks and stuff like that to meet deadline. And that was something that EGM was infamous for and really good at was getting exclusives. They weren't always honorable ways of getting an exclusive.
Right.
But they would be able to go to press so much faster than everybody else from that standpoint.
And that's what drove subscriptions and people buying it was like, oh, they want to know about this game, and they were first to punch, out.
Exactly. My time with them just sort of came to a close where I started making, you know, I would have certain sections I was responsible for as far as like writing articles. So I would have to call, you know, like Capcom or Namco to know when, hey, when is the game going to come in and stuff like that. And that was, actually another thing too, is like working at the magazine was awesome standpoint because it was Christmas every day. You were either getting a new batch of games in or a new system in, and you'd get stuff in a year, you know, 6 months, a year before it hit the market. Wow. And like, yeah, there was time, like, I'm like, I cannot believe I'm getting paid to play a game that no one else is able to play for another year. Or this, you know, I'm like, oh my God, I got the Sega Saturn, you know, CD. I can, you know.
Right. New hardware and stuff like that. Yeah,
stuff like hot from, you know, smells like China. You know, I just got this and I can't believe this.
Right off the boat. Stuff here like it is.
It was so cool. But as I started having my own contacts to get, you know, hey, when is this game coming in for so I can meet my deadline? You know, they would start to not so much badmouth me, but, you know, not be nice about, you know, about EGM. And, you know, there's a lot of history and there's a lot of stories about EGM. And the thing was, you know, there were a lot of things that they did that I did not find really honorable and from a business standpoint. And I don't want to, I won't say too much more than that. And that was the reason for me wanting to, wanting to leave. And it was nothing more than that. You know, I just like, you know, I want to really build a career for myself and a good name. And I feel like sometimes when I try to talk to somebody, they would say, oh, you're EGM, you work for the Devil magazine. I'm like, oh, good Lord.
You work for Satan. You know,
You know, and then there were these crazy rumors like, you know, oh, Steve Harris is such a bad man. We heard he has to wear a bulletproof vest whenever he goes out. I'm like, that is crazy. I'm like, and I bet someone in our company actually started that rumor, you know, just to, just to make the madness even in more so. I just started talking to some of my contacts, and one of my contacts at Capcom was like, you know, Chris, you know, we really like working with you, but, you know, we don't want to give you information first because of, you know, we're having relationship issues with management at EGM. And they were like, you know, there are openings at GamePro over in San Francisco. You know, you should really jump ship and go over there. And I'm like, you know, like it was hard for me to like not even explore it. And I remember I when I interviewed with the upper management at GamePro first, and they were like scared of me. They thought I was like a spy. And I'm like, oh my God.
Spy from Chicago working for them.
So they were really timid to even talk to me. Like, and they were like, look, you only had this interview because Lori Thornton at Capcom highly recommended you. You know, we don't like your magazine. We do things much differently at GamePro. We have structure. We have an HR department. And I'm thinking to myself, I'm like, what's an HR department? I'm like, 1993. I don't know what the hell you're talking about. And you know, so they were making me even nervous. And the meeting quickly took a turn when the editor in chief was like, he goes, so what's your title at EGM? I go, I'm an associate editor. He goes, well, we have associate editors. What's an associate editor at EGM do? And I'd say, well, you know, first I pick the game I'm going to write on, and then I play it. I take my screenshots. Then I open up Cork Express, and I start laying out, you know, where the images are going to go, and I start writing my text. And then I go into Photoshop, and I start working on my background. And then if I have to scan some art, and then from there I cut it out, and I work on Illustrator. And as I'm talking, their eyes are just like, and their mouth are just dropping. And I'm like, I'm like, what? I'm like, don't you guys do the same thing? He goes, no, man, we have an art department. I'm like, what the hell's an art department?
I mean, I can just write? Like, did I have to do all that other shit?
He goes, we're just editorial. I go, well, what does that mean? He goes, we just play it again, write the text. And I go, well, what do you do after lunch? I'm like, seriously? I'm like, that's like a half. I'm like, what? That's all you do? He's like, yeah, we have an entire art team that does everything. And at that point, I'm like, oh my God, I know more than the editor in chief of GamePro magazine. It was crazy. It was.
Was that Wes? There was a really class. Yeah, Wes was a good. He was a class act. I remember interfacing with him a little bit, and talking with some stuff. I can't remember where I was at, but I remember just having a good impression of him, thinking like, yeah, this guy gets it.
Wes Mihay was
exactly.
The nicest guy. Always, he was cool as a cucumber all the time. I've never, ever, ever seen him lose his cool. And I gave him plenty of options. You know, because I was still young, you know, and kind of hot-headed. And I had a lot of the EGM aggression of like, let's go, let's move faster, let's get this out, let's get exclusive. And they'd be like, we don't do it like that. You gotta, you know, relax. We're gonna put you in a timeout, you know, just relax. Right.
It's a little more professional.
So it was so much more professional. It was my first year at GamePro was really rough. You know, when I came in, a lot of people were scared that I was coming in, and to some degree I was, to teach the editorial staff how to do the things that I learned at EGM, how to use Illustrator, how to use Photoshop, how to do certain things, just to, you know, just to understand the process of making the magazine. And the art team at GamePro got wind of it and then assimilated, you know, the idea that I was going to, you know, all their jobs were going to be
put them out of a job. Oh God. Yeah.
Put them out of a job. And so before before I even started there, I had half of a staff hating me and thinking that I was in there to just clean house. I'm like, I'm 22 years old.
Right, right.
And my job.
I don't like doing desktop publishing. You do your thing. I'll do my thing. Peace out, man.
And I'm like, and my title is associate editor. I have no power over anybody. EGM was fast, in your face, aggressive, and cutting edge. And GamePro was very corporate, very structured, and had great connections and was able to do things, but they moved at a much slower pace. But they did things the way that I wanted. You know, they had a great reputation. They were well liked. And you know, if you worked for the magazine, you know, it was, you know, it meant something. You know, and it meant like, you know, ability and from the standpoint that, you know, people, wow, you know, it was respected, which was
probably easier too when you're reaching out to the publishers and trying to get games or the console manufacturers that. They're like, okay, this is legit. It's GamePro, not EGM. So we're not going to be
absolutely
skeptical.
Absolutely. And then location wise, John, it was great because we were
Bay Area, right?
Yeah. Down the street was Foster City, Sony's headquarters. You know, another 3 miles was Sega's headquarters. EA was, I can literally see EA's old building right across the street from our building.
Right. That's smart. Yeah, with the location. Yeah.
And it made it really great. And then there were a lot of like local parties and, you know, game launches that were just in the Bay Area, just because, you know, everyone's already here. Why do we need to have a party anywhere else and stuff like that? So the amount of people that I was able to meet and connect with when I worked at GamePro for 3 years, 2 years, I think it was 3 years, was great.
Great really for the Rolodex, great. Right? Yeah,
yes,
that's great.
Yeah. But the biggest, I'll be real, the biggest problem I always had when I used to write for the magazine was I was always really good at playing the game. And I was notorious for like especially at GamePro, the best one at playing a game. Like there were so many times like, hey, Chris, can you come in here? I need to give the screenshot, but I can't beat this level. Yeah, sure. And I was that guy, but I was absolutely the worst editor. I had grammar structure issues and just I had a hard time. It took me 3 times longer than it took anybody else to actually write the article, but thank God it took me, you know, a tenth of the time to actually play the game to get the screen. So I did struggle from that standpoint. Actually, it was the real reason why I got out of desktop publishing and being an editor, because I just didn't have a passion for writing. I had a passion for playing video games and being part of that process. And that's really where I wanted to go. And because of it, that's how I got my first short role making video games with a company called Endspace. In Florida,
right? Okay, right, so, yeah.
they brought me in, I think it was 1996 or 95. Mm. And I only stayed there like 6 months. The problem was that they brought me in so early as a producer, and the team was so small. So we would have like, we would go through like a list of tasks that had to be done. And I'm like, okay, guys, we need to do this, 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 this. And they're like, okay, cool. We'll see you in 3 weeks. I'm like, what? They're like, well, yeah, this takes time to do. And I would literally, John, I had nothing else to do.
Right.
I was bored to death. And I remember I'd call home and I'd tell my friends, I'm like, I'm bored. They're like, they're paying you to make video games and you're complaining that you're bored. I'm like, you don't understand. I'm used to like, you know, coming from deadlines.
Yeah.
I'm dying. I'm dying with the culture shock of moving from San Francisco to Florida. I go, this is crazy.
Thinking too, to loop back about the part about playing games, like when TurboGrafx shut down, Turbo Technologies Incorporated wanted me to join them out in the LA, and it was Hudson Soft, and they formed TTI and they had that company going. And I wasn't comfortable moving to LA, and you know, I already kind of saw the writing on the wall. So they're like, just work out of your house and find bugs and work on manuals and stuff like that. So I was like, okay. And then I was like, all right, I am not the best at playing games. Like, who can help me with this? And there were two people who came to mind, and it was you and Mike Casso. So I had a company for a couple of years, maybe a year and a half, I don't know, called The Testing Source. But basically I would, and this is, you know, pre-internet days, where there would be FedExes showing up at my apartment and there would be ROMs with the games in there. And then we would test the games. And then I remember that. And you would show up, yeah. You had your white Mustang, and then you come by the apartment and we'd sit there and you'd find the bugs and I'd type them up and print it out and on FileMaker 4 and then fax over an actual fax machine, the bug report. But, you know, it was like, who kicked ass playing games? And it was like Mike Casso and Chris Nicolaou. Those are the two people.
I really appreciated the opportunity. It was great, you know, from taking a break from, you know, talking to, you know, a kid like, how does Bonk get big, which he does. right. And, you know, because you also helped me, like, from a standpoint, like, I took a lot of the screenshots for the back of the box art.
Yep.
And then like some of the later commercials, any of the game footage was me playing it. And that was because, well, you'd be like, hey man, I need you to go in the city. And you know, they need to get some footage of Air Bonk or whatever it was, and that was because of you. And then I you know, the opportunities like that was great. And I really appreciate it. Those were fun times.
Okay. Quick question break. What are your thoughts so far? Do you have a topic idea, a question to ask, or a guest suggestion? Let me know at 224-484-7733 or on the gamedevadvice.com website.
So what do you wish you had known when you had started? Just kind of flashback.
Oh, man. There's a lot of things. I did some of them correctly. There's a lot of things I didn't do right. I wish I would have just been a little bit more open. Like there were a lot of times where I'd get into a routine and I would stick to it. I wouldn't like go around and meet other people to see what other departments were doing and learn other aspects. At GamePro, when I was in San Francisco, connecting more and meeting more people. I did it a little bit, but I was a little introverted back then because my whole life was just playing video games. So, and it was, you know, for a time, it's sad to say, I had a difficult time having a conversation if it wasn't related to a video game. You know, talking about real life events and stuff like that was really tough for me. Mm. And I wish I would have socialized a little bit more than I did, because I had everything available to me, especially in those times. And there were times like, oh, I should really go to this this launch party or this, and just go there to like hang out and meet people and be like, and I didn't do that a lot. I guess one of the best things I can recommend, and I'm glad I did it, was, you know, don't burn bridges. Because I tell you that, you know, both the toy industry and the video industry, they're really, really small. And the people you meet on the way up, you know, and this is true. The people you meet on the way up are going to be people you meet, you know, on the way down when you're sustaining.
Or parallel in the future. Yeah, right.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, think about it. You know, here and I, you know, you and I were friends, and we've known each other for 22. Yeah. No, I'm sorry.
No, 30 years. Yeah, 30 years.
Well,
89 was when it started, but yeah, 28 years probably when you started, 1991, something like that. Yeah.
And officially, we have not worked together since the TurboGrafx days. I mean, there were times where I think we crossed paths just a little bit, but never worked at the same company together. And, you know, we've always stayed in touch. And I think that's really important. If you want, you know, starting out and things that, you know, that I wish I would have done a little bit better is just is meet and just associate more. And I'm glad I didn't burn a lot of bridges.
Yeah. People do that and then they're shocked.
Yeah.
You know, why they have problems. It's like,
exactly.
When you go into a couple companies with flamethrowers, word gets around, dude. And then, you know, reputation is key. And it's, and again, it's not what you say, it's what you do and how you act and how you treat people. So when
that, John, I can't emphasize that more. And especially like what you said about, it's like when you're leaving a company, don't throw, as much as you may want to, don't throw a hand grenade. Just what's it going to do? I mean, you're going to feel great for like 20 minutes and it could affect you.
20 years.
Exactly. Right. It affects you so much. It gets you nowhere. It really, really does. Just pretend you did it in your head and, you know.
right. So you've worked on tons of projects, video games, magazines, toys. Like, is there one or two you can pick? It's like a favorite or, you know, these really spit out, you know.
Yeah, like, absolutely. So if we want to go back far, at EGM, probably the coolest thing I did at EGM was I got to work, and I have no idea how I got this. I got to work on and write the article for Donkey Kong Country when it first came out. And that was amazing. There's a pretty funny backstory regarding that, a typical EGM story regarding it. You know, back in the day, whenever a new Nintendo game came out, they would most companies would just send the games, you know, send the ROMs and, you know, and that was it. But with a Nintendo game, they brought a representative, and that ROM never left that Nintendo representative's site. You know, it's like, okay.
In the suitcase with the handcuffs, and they'd open it up.
Yeah. It was crazy. Like, there were times, like, I can remember, I don't remember what Nintendo game I was playing, and the Nintendo rep's like, I have to go to the bathroom. I'm like, okay. They're like, and she would just stare at me. I'm like, you don't need my permission to go to the bathroom. She's like, no, I'm taking the game with me. I'm like, I go, you're really going to take this game into the bathroom with you? She's like, I have to. All right, you know, whatever. That's interesting. My favorite video game of all time that I ever worked on, the game I'm most proud of, is NBA Street Volume 2. When it was still, we were still new FX before EA took us over. That game, I don't know how much you played the game. That game was, it was awesome. It was perfection. It looked amazing. It played great. It was, you know, I know you worked at Midway, so you're very
right. With Ballers and Gomez and Johnny V and all that. Yeah.
It was such a great game. And, you know, we had an amazing roster. You know, we had every NBA team, and then we had classic players. So we had Larry Bird from his heyday. We
Magic,
had Magic, Kareem. We had three versions of Michael Jordan. We had
with hair.
And it was hard. It was a hard game. It was a hard deadline, you know. So we worked crazy hours towards the end. Yeah. And that was the time where I didn't go home for like, you know, like 8 weeks and slept on a desk multiple nights. I remember, those crunch days are crazy. And I remember we finally got zero bugs and we submitted to all three. This was one of the first games that we did for all three, you know, because Xbox, the original Xbox was out. Mm-hmm. So it was GameCube, PlayStation 2, and Xbox, the original.
The weak, underpowered GameCube and the other two systems,
exactly.
With less disk space,
oh my God, that game would crash all the time because of running out of disk space. It was a nightmare. We're submitted, you know, we know we're not going to hear anything for, you know, a couple of weeks, and I get a call, and at the time, even though we were NewFX, the game was basically funded and run by EA Vancouver out of the EA Vancouver office. Beautiful. And the head producer calls me and he goes, hey, Chris, we're thinking about taking the game out of submission and adding a few things. I'm like, what are you talking about?
Well, ship sail, like, man, no more.
I know.
No,
I'm like, what are you doing? What are you using? He goes, well, we're thinking about putting in another player. I'm like, who? We have people. I think we have people that are dead. I'm like, who else are you going to put in there? We have classic players. We have three versions of Jordan. I'm like,
all right. What do you want?
I'm like, he goes, well, we're thinking about not even putting in an NBA player in. I'm like, what are you talking about? He goes, we're thinking about putting in a kid in high school. I'm like, a kid in high school? I go, what are you talking about? He goes, we're thinking about putting in LeBron James. And I was at this point, I was so angry. I go, who the fuck is LeBron James? Why is he killing my deadline? He goes, you don't know who he is? I'm like, no. I go, I don't know who this high school kid is. I'm like, what are you talking about? He goes, he's amazing. And you know, like, he sells out all these high school, his games. And, you know, he's probably going to go first in the draft. And he's going to go right from high school to the NBA. And I'm like, I think that's a terrible idea. I don't think, you know, what are the odds of this LeBron James being any good at all? You know, great that he's good in high school. I go, that's a terrible idea. I really hope we don't. And we didn't do it just because the NBA was like, look, you can't really put somebody in that we haven't signed yet. So, but it's just hilarious that here I am, bad-mouthing, you know, arguably the best, you know, NBA player on the planet. Why is LeBron ruining my game?
My son Jack he calls him the GOAT. So I tend to differ with him a little bit on that. But yeah, he definitely turned into something after high school, no doubt. So yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I started working at Tiger Electronics a year before Hasbro bought us. The first project I ever worked on was Gigapets. And, you know, we made Gigapets because we got an early version of Tamagotchi and they were all the rage in Japan. Right. And I'm like, oh, you know, this is cool. We'll see how it does. And, you know, I had no idea that, you know, it was going to be huge. And we sold 20 million Gigapets.
Wow. 20 million. That's crazy.
20 million. I was in the, I was in the original meeting when the inventor came in with Furby. And Furby at the time, it was just a videotape. It was all puppeteered, all faked. And right when I saw, even when I saw that faked puppet videotape, I'm like, this thing's a home run. I mean, I knew right away. I'm like, if they can actually do everything they say, this toy is going to be huge. And I remember it took a year and a half to make Furby happen. It was so complicated at the time, you know, in the late 90s. And thank God Hasbro took us over because we were able to use a lot of their engineering, a lot of their model shops and do things that Tiger just wasn't equipped to do.
And they had deeper pockets, right? So
deeper pockets. And they believed in it as well. Mm-hmm. And I worked on Furby a little bit, but I worked on Furby more so when it was getting closer to launch. Mm-hmm. They liked how I used to present and talk about products. So they're like, Chris, we want to make you the Furby spokesman and go to the media and show what it does and talk about it and go to the buyers and 'cause a lot of
toy show buyers. In New York and all that stuff.
And I remember a lot of the buyers were pissed off because we were so late and we kept raising the price on it. And like, you know what? I don't even think I'm going to take this stupid thing. And I'd be like, I go, look, I'm in product development. You know, I'm a producer. I make toys. I'm not a sales guy. I'm here to show you how the toy works. I go, I'm telling you, this toy is magic out of a box. And I go, I know you're pissed at us. I know we're late. You're still going to get it in time for Christmas. I know you might have to air freight product in. I'm telling you, this thing is going to be huge. And it sold 40 million units. We had five factories in China, you know, working 24 hours a day, cranking them out. It was crazy. I was even blessed. I got to go to the launch party was at F.A.O. Schwartz in New York, where we only had 5,000 of them. Mark Rosenberg is a genius marketing PR guy, put on the event, had kids from local schools show up and pretend they were excited about a toy. They had no idea what it was. And we sold out 5,000 units in 2 hours.
And just to like frame this for people, like Furbies were huge. Like the stores would get them, and then I knew a guy that would drive around and get them, and then he would sell them on eBay. And bought like, it was crappy, but he bought like a Corvette with the money he made, like flipping the Furbies, right? So, I mean, this was like, you know, Google it or Wikipedia, but it was like a cultural phenomenon. I mean, this
absolutely, in all seriousness, Furbies were trading higher than gold. They literally were. It was unbelievable. I literally, I was getting people calling me that I hadn't talked to in years.
Right. It's like we're in the lotto, like, hey, Chris, you hook me up?
You remember me from, you know, from daycare when we were 5 years old? I, you know, we at nap time, I was the kid that drooled next to you. Can you give me a Furby? The Hasbro days were awesome. You know, I got to work on
Star Wars, right?
Star Wars. I worked on episode, you know, 1, 2, and 3. You know, I was a huge Star Wars fan. You know, I loved it so much. And to be able to be at a job that I got to work on the toys for the upcoming movie, which was, you know, at the time, we didn't know any better. We thought was going to be, you know, bigger than, you know, the original trilogy. You know, we, you know, episode 1, 2, and 3, you know, it's been 25 years and, you know, people have been waiting. You know, episode one is going to be amazing. And I remember as soon as Hasbro signed the contract with Lucas, we were already late. You know, the movie was coming out in 11 months. So I remember this is so great. So we, I wish I had a smartphone back then. This was like 98. They're like, we have to get assets and start working on it right away. So we're taking Hasbro corporate jet to Skywalker Ranch, where you're going to go read the script on Skywalker Ranch. I'm like, I'm doing like, what?
Do we, was ist los? What?
So we literally took corporate jet to fly out to Skywalker Ranch. And I read episode one sitting in a rocking chair on George Lucas's porch. I'm like,
really?
I'm like, you can't make this up.
Right. And I'm like, they frisked you and you walked in?
the amount of
security?
NDAs I had to sign. I literally think I some of the fine print that George wrote, like, if you talk about this, we deport you to Yemen or something like that.
Right. You're dead.
It was insane. You know, so those were just amazing times. And, you know, it's too bad, you know, episode 1, 2, and 3 didn't do as well as everyone liked. And the toys didn't do that. The toys, unfortunately, they did okay. They didn't do anything as
damn Jar Jar Binks or whatever. Yeah, that's.
You know, the funny thing is, like, I remember when I'm reading the script, and I've read some scripts before, and you know, scripts are hard to read. You have to really read the subsections to understand the scene setup and who's talking and you know stuff like that. So they're tough. But I got used to it. But I remember when I was reading episode one, and I'm like, I don't get this. I'm like, why is he talking in this strange southern, you know, draw, and what the hell is a midichlorian? And I'm like, I don't get this script. But I here's my thinking. You know, at the time we were so excited. Yeah. I'm like, I was like, you know what? This script is so good. I'm not smart enough to understand it. And I'm just, for me, not getting. I just blame myself, John. I was just like, you know what? It's awesome.
I'm just missing something. There's something or whatever.
Yeah, and even as it got closer and we started seeing dailies and some images and stuff like that, and as it got closer and closer, you know, I was a little nervous. I still thought I was going to do really, really well. Yeah. The biggest shocker I ever had was I had a good buddy of mine was visiting me from Chicago, and he was the epitome of a Star Wars fan. Mm. And he was always begging me, Chris, tell me something about it. Tell me, like, it was like, oh my God, it's Man in 96 all over again. Tell me something about the movie. I'm like, I can't, man. I can't tell you stuff. Yeah. He's like, come on. I go on the forums and I read all the stuff. Tell me something. I go, the movie comes out in 3 weeks. You really want me to say something? He goes, yes, spoil something. And I'm like,
here's some alcohol, like, speak.
Yeah, pretty much. And we were outside and we were just tossing the ball back and forth, just playing catch.
Yeah.
And I'm like, at one point he was just getting me so pissed off. I'm like, all right, I'm really going to say something that's just going to spoil it. And he hit the ball and he was about to throw it. And I go, okay, I'll tell you something. Darth Maul dies. And he stops mid-throw. And he goes, what? I go, yeah, Darth Maul dies. He goes, no, he doesn't. I'm like, dude. He goes, why would they do that? He's like the new Darth Vader, and they spent all this time building up. They're going to kill him in the first movie? I go, they kill him in like the second act. He's like, what? He didn't believe me. He thought I was making it.
You're just saying that to get me off your back. Right, yeah.
Right?
It's not true. George would never do that.
George would never do that. Not the George I know.
Right. Are there any games like you're playing now or you're excited about? Or you said you got your Xbox. Is there anything you're doing?
So I think I'm the only... one here in Thailand that has an Xbox One. everybody else is PlayStation. And, you know, I love the PlayStation, but I had to I had to actually move away from the PlayStation for work when I was working for a private toy company, for a small toy company called Zizzle. I worked from them from like from 2005 to 2010. I was the director of product development for handheld games, and it was great. I was working on movie license stuff and video game stuff, you know, translating into really horrible dot matrix screens. You know, it was a lot of fun. But early on, I think it was like 2000, early on in 2005, our licensing manager came to me. She goes, "What do you know about Halo?" And at the time, I'm like, I was just a PlayStation boy. I'm like, I know Halo. I know it's
that Master Chief guy.
Yeah, I know it's really big, and I know people love it. And I think Halo 2 was out for like a year and a half or something like that. She goes, "Well, Universal Studios is teaming up with Microsoft, and they're going to make a movie. And we have the opportunity to make toys. Do you want to do it?" And I knew right away. I'm like, "Yes, absolutely. I know it's big enough that we have to be a part of it." She said, "Well, you need to put a deck together and a pitch meeting in 2 weeks." So that means, like, you know, I had to buy an Xbox, and I started, you know, I had to start playing Halo, and I liked Halo a lot. You know, I first played the story mode, you know, just like I got to get immersed into the lore and understand it. I remember I beat the game. I'm like, "Oh, this is cool," but I'm like, "I don't get what everyone's making a big deal about." And then one day I'm like, "Let me try this multiplayer thing." And it was just like, you know, my world you know, blew up. Their online multiplayer 4-on-4 was awesome. And it just hooked me. And ever since then, you know, I was a Halo fan and then Xbox fan from that standpoint. So I'm a big Halo fan. Oh, as far as the movie goes, so we pitched, you know, I don't know if you know the history of the Halo movie.
No.
We pitched the toy line. They loved it. They were going to give it to us, but then they there was a lot of just back and forth between Microsoft and the studio as far as like
it never came out, right?
It never came out. Actually, you want to know some really interesting history. So they did a ton of pre-work for Halo, you know, as far as like developing weaponry, stories, and backstory. And they had a lot of stuff already kind of like pre-planned out. And when it got killed, they decided to use as much as they could. So the Halo movie actually turned into District 9. I don't know if you remember District 9 was the movie where the alien race comes down and
So was Smith in that, or am I? But yeah, that's cool.
You know, I'm a big Halo guy. You know, I play Halo. I haven't played as much. I hope the new one is good. I've been a retro kick, so I've been playing. I'm on my second version of playing Resident Evil 2, the remake. So I'm playing that.
I just
downloaded the Castlevania library of games on Xbox. There's like 6 or 7 versions of Castlevania, so I've been playing that a lot. I still play Killer Instinct, which is a fighting game. And part of the reason why I play that was that was like one of the last toy lines I worked on when I was working at Ultimate Source Create.
So is there anything else I should have asked you about but didn't, Chris?
Yeah, you know, one of my favorite stories working in the toy industry was, you know, we were really great from the standpoint that we were allowed to get access to scripts, and we were closely with movie studios all the time. And when I was working with Zizzle, I was in charge of development for the handheld game line. So I had contacts at Disney, at Marvel, at Lucas and so forth. And I remember one time, I think it was early 2006, my main contact at Marvel calls me and he goes, "Hey, we're doing something really big." I'm like, "Okay." He goes, "We're launching our very own movie studio. You know, we're not going to sell off any more of our movies. You know, we're not going to give any more to, you know, maybe Spider-Man is with Sony, X-Men is with Fox." He goes, "That's it. We're not doing it anymore. we're going to launch our own movie studio. And I'm like, oh, that's awesome. He goes, yeah, yeah, yeah. And he goes, we want you to start working on some of the toys for the first movie. And it's going to come out in 2008. So I'm like, okay, cool. I'm thinking of timelines. 2 years. I have 2 years to work on this. This is great. I go, cool. What's your first movie? He goes, it's going to be Iron Man. And I'm like, Iron Man? I'm like, Iron Man's okay. I'm like, and I remember I said, this is so embarrassing. I go, you sure you can't get X-Men back? He's like, no, we can't get X-Men back.
Yeah. And I'm like, Tony Stark, do it.
I go, yeah. He goes, no, we're going to launch with Iron Man and it's going to be awesome. And I go, okay, well, tell me about it. He goes, we already know who we're going to have play Iron Man. I go, okay, who's it going to be? He goes, Robert Downey Jr. I go, Robert Downey Jr. from Ally McBeal? I'm like,
he hasn't been in the movie. Is he passed out in someone's house right now? What's going on? He had a rough period there for a while.
I go, he hasn't been in a movie for years. It's great that he is getting his act back together. He's on TV. But I don't see Robert Downey Jr. pulling this off. I'm like, he hasn't played in a movie and been a lead forever. I go, well, who's going to direct it? And he goes, Jon Favreau. I go, the guy that directed Elf? I go, wait a second. You're telling me you're going to launch your movie career studio on Iron Man, which is not like an A title.
It's not the premiere, right?
No, I'm like, you know, everybody cares about X-Men and Spider-Man. That's the only thing that really people care about. And you're going to do it with Robert Downey Jr. and Jon Favreau as the director. He's like, yeah, man, are you in? And I'm like, I don't think so. I think I'm gonna pass. He goes, really? Are you sure? He goes, I go. Well, you know, let me think about it for a little bit, and I'll get back to you. I hang up the phone. I'm like, I shook my head. I'm like, oh, good Lord, they're gonna crash, and crash and burn. So
what are they thinking?
What were they thinking? They don't know what they're doing. Eight or 9 months go by, and then the first teaser trailer for Iron Man comes out, and I see it, and I'm like, oh my God, that looks amazing. But then I try to, you know, get realistic, like, okay, it's just a trailer. Trailers are misleading. Still be terrible. You know, don't freak out. Smoke and mirrors. Smoke and mirrors. And then the next trailer came out and I'm just like, oh my God. Oh my God. Really like freaking, I'm like, what did I do? And then we got early access to the premiere. And in the whole office went. And I remember I sat next to the owner of the company, you know, the my boss.
Yeah.
And the movie's amazing. I'm watching the movie and I'm just like, oh my God, what did I do? I cannot believe I passed on this. I could have had a whole toy line out. This movie's gonna be huge. The movie ends and my boss turns to me and he goes, Chris, didn't we have an opportunity to get Iron Man? And I'm like, who needs more popcorn? It's one of the biggest mistakes I made in my toy career. But you know, I didn't. Yeah. Nobody knew that it was going to be
right
as it was. I mean,
honestly, in that paper, the way you explain it, it's like, yeah, that seems like a stretch, right? You know, and if they had stuff to show you or part of a script or more details, but you know, hey, you got Furby, right? So I mean,
yeah, I got Furby.
You got 40 million Furbies. Where can people find you online? Is there anything you want to share? Like, do you have a Twitter account or a website, or are you just kind of laying low?
Yeah. So I'm not laying low. I thought I was going to lay low. So I came out to Thailand to just I don't want to say fully retire. I told myself I was going to like semi-retire.
Right.
But the closer I got to like coming out here and telling more people, a lot of old comics are like, well, if you're no longer working for Korea, the last toy company I worked for, like we would love to work for. And really part of the reasons why I moved to Bangkok was it's super close to China. And so, you know, normally if I'm in Chicago and I'm working on a toy line or product and I have to go to the factory, you know, it takes a day and a half to get there. And it costs around, you know, $3,000 between the flights and everything else.
So,
it's a lot of work just to get there. And now me being in Bangkok, you know, it takes me 2 hours to get into China and cost $300. So I mean, it's just, yeah. So yeah. The pitch I do is like, look, if you have a problem at the factory on Monday morning, I could be there Monday afternoon, making it much worse. is the pitch I tell people. They get a laugh and they're like, wow, that's actually, you know, makes a lot of sense that you're so close to that region. I've been going to Hong Kong since it was still British owned. So it's been 20 some years. Yeah. And that flight is brutal. You know, it's especially back in the day before smartphones, before iPads.
Yeah.
You brought a magazine, you brought a CD player.
Walkman and tried to kill the 16 hours or whatever the flight was. Yeah.
Right. You just drink yourself into oblivion until you pass out because it's, you know, it's 15 hours.
Yeah.
It's a long time.
I'm
actually consulting for a few different toy companies. It's mostly I'm working with people that I've worked with in the past that I consider really good friends, and they're fun projects. The only one I can talk about is, you know, they're relaucching Gigapets. It's been like over 20 years. So I'm working on, I'm, you know, everything comes full circle. I'm working on Gigapets. They're hitting retail. In the next couple of months, but you can find them now on Amazon and everything like that. But as far as reaching me, the one thing that's really funny is my last company, I created their Twitter account and I built it up, you know, working with a lot of people at Microsoft, a lot of people in the gaming industry, a lot of people in the esports community. And after I left, they're like, hey, Chris, you know, you really created that Twitter account and you're the one that's always managed it. So, you know, why don't you just keep it? I actually have and able to maintain the Ultimate Source Twitter account. So if there's ever anybody that wants to reach out and get to me on Twitter, it's just at Ultimate Toy, which is, you know, Ultimate, then Toy.
Yeah, I'll put in the show notes. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So that's the easiest way if you want to, you know, hit me up on Twitter that way. I'm on LinkedIn. Yeah. So day to day, I work on fun projects. I'm able to, you know, work out of my condo here in Bangkok, which is really, really nice. I'm in a really fun, lively section in Thailand. So it's great. Yeah. So in the year that I've been here, I've been to Hong Kong 4 times, China twice, Vietnam once, Japan twice, and then all over through Thailand. And the reason is just because it's easy and it's super cheap because I'm already on this side of the planet. So
yeah, you're already there, right?
You know, a flight to Japan is only 4 hours and it costs like $300. A flight to Hong Kong is $200. A flight to Vietnam is barely $100. You know,
damn.
So it's great. So I've been
very cool.
Exploring the region day to day. Which is fantastic.
Yeah. No, and
you gotta come visit.
I know. I got to get over there. Definitely. That it's super interesting. And that's great that you can see all those areas. And it's like a great launching pad to go travel, you know, Southeast Asia there. And
I would say definitely come meet me in Thailand or in Hong Kong, but maybe not so much now in Hong Kong.
Yeah, I was going to say, because this is going to be a little delayed and who knows when it's released, what's going on. But yeah, with all this stuff going on with Hong Kong and the NBA, and there's like a kind of whole shitstorm going on with the NBA fighting with China and stuff. Like, what do you see over there, or what do you see, you know, with the news and stuff? Is there any like perspective you have? What's going on as an American in Bangkok?
Sure. So I was just there 2 weeks ago. I went to Macau, which is like the Asian version of Las Vegas.
So
it's just a big gambling city, which was a lot of fun, and. I took the ferry through the harbor to Hong Kong. So I was in Hong Kong just 2 weeks ago, just for dinner, and took the ferry back to Macau to lose lots of money. And you know, my history with Hong Kong runs really, really deep. You know, I've been going there since 1997. I have so many friends, so many really, really good friends in Hong Kong, and you know, I feel really, really bad. I feel really bad for Hong Kong, the people. You know, they've grown up under so much freedom, being under British rule.
Right.
And you know, when the changeover happened in '99, everyone thought right then and there it was going to get really, really bad, and it didn't. It didn't for a long time, and now we're 20 years after the handoff. Yeah, and it's supposed to be another 25 years or 20 some years before the fully get integrated into China. Honestly, I don't want to get too political, but I just feel really bad because I don't think there's any hope for them. And I feel bad because they've had a great life and a great taste of so much democracy and freedom and expression. And every day it gets a little bit more taken away from them. And I feel so bad. And I don't think there's anything they can do, you know?
Yeah.
I was going to say, it was great for like the first 10 weeks, you know, almost all the protests were peaceful and that didn't do it. Now the protests, you know, in some regards have gotten violent and that's not working. And I just don't, see how things are going to change for them. And I just, I feel really, really bad.
You've got such excellent stories. It's been great talking. And I think people are really going to enjoy this podcast and just learning about the game industry, the toy industry, the magazine industry for game publishing. And
thanks, John. Well, I really appreciate the opportunity. It was a blast chatting. We haven't chatted in a while. And going down memory lane and talking about just some of the crazy stories. My advice to people that always try to get into the, you know, video game industry or the toy industry is, you know, just be modest, be good at least one thing. So you're always that go-to guy for that for that one thing.
Yeah, right.
And just network and just, you just make friends and just learn other aspects of the job, even if they don't pertain to you. It's just helpful. It just makes you more valuable and, you know, helps you grow in your career.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Game Dev Advice, the Game Developers Podcast. If you found it interesting or helpful, please leave a 5-star review. I'd really appreciate it. And don't forget to subscribe. I have a lot of great episodes coming out. As always, I want to hear from you, the game development community. So give me a call at 224-484-7733 or reach out on the website, gamedevadvice.com. I want to know your struggles, your questions, and your ideas. Since the podcast is really about you, the fellow game developer, and our game development community. Thanks and take care.